Hi everyone, welcome to the Talking Split podcast. I'm Rob Calder. With me I have Mike Zeppel and Justin Massive Schuller, the high performance coaches for Metro and Country. Welcome guys.
I wasn't even going to use that one this week.
Not a chance, you would have got 2 minutes in and dropped something again. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, which you can get on iTunes and the Basketball Victoria website. If you haven't already, please do leave a rating and a review on the podcast. It helps us to know what we're doing and if it's helpful for you guys as coaches as well, and if we're getting the right content for you guys. We do have a massive show, to steal Justin's words. We have a new segment. We have Ian Dunican on for the second part of the podcast talking about sleep in athletes. But to start off with, we do have an email in from a listener, Coach Mark, who's talking about substitutions and how you use your bench in games, what methods you'd use to make sure you can get all your kids in games, how you work your bench. Who plays their best five kids to start? I know with my under-12s, I certainly don't. I try and rotate those starters fairly regularly if I can, but do you guys have a philosophy on, do you start your best kids? Do you try and even it out a little bit? What do you guys do?
I think before we even start, probably we'll try and talk on all levels. So that question is really different depending what level you're working with. Far away, Zep, what do you do?
As you just said, level-based. I think with juniors and development, so Robbie coaching under-12s, probably a good opportunity to rotate starters for the whole year, I would think. Especially if you've got your bottom eights, you're talking about 9, 10-year-olds playing under-12 basketball. I'm not sure that the starting five or the backup five will be much different from each other. As you get through to under-14s and there comes a distinct talent difference or ability difference, I think it changes again. Then as you get to your top age 18s, your Siebel, your Big B, and then your pros, I think a rotation based on what you need at certain parts of the game to start the game well, to end the first half well, becomes pretty important.
Yeah, I think it comes down to what level you're working on from are you trying to develop all 10 guys you've got? And if that's the case, then finding ways through that. But as you go up levels, other things determine that as well, like injury. Yep. Your best player may get injured, he's out for a period of time. You integrate him back through the bench because one, gives him some confidence against their second unit. Two, the team's been going along and they've found their way without them. It might also be game-to-game needs. Yep. So, they may have someone that comes in off the bench really strong, so I need to be able to match that, and those sorts of things come into it as well. But I don't think there is a formula that's a guaranteed success with it. I do agree that probably the lower you go, the more you've got to try and find a way to balance that out. And I know that the development tournaments we just had recently, that was an instruction that try and balance what you're doing. But even at a senior level, you're always trying to keep two of your studs on the floor. At the same time, you're not wanting to clear the bench and have the whole bench in.
People like routine as well. Yeah. So I think what helps a lot of athletes is actually knowing when you're going to come into the game. Am I going to start? Because you'll see that throw an athlete off completely if you tell them the morning of or the day before the game, hey, we're not starting you tonight, or whatever the issue is, that it will actually throw them because they're just not used to it. So routine's a big part in rotations when you're developing at a development tournament or under-12s basketball. They're probably less ingrained in their routine as an elder.
That being said, I think as a coach it's a luxury if you don't have a set starting lineup and you're able to kind of go against who you're playing that week and whatnot. But what I would say is a set rotation is not a bad thing. Finding a way to let them understand this is your role tonight, this is what you've got to do, definitely is going to have some positive outcomes on that.
So we see that in the NBA a fair bit, especially when it gets to sort of playoffs time. The Spurs have been one of the big exponents of, do they start Ginobili, who's traditionally a sixth man?
Yep.
Do they make the change? How many times would you try and be proactive with that change and throw off the other team? If you maybe have a set starting group, would you change, or would you sit there and say, bad luck, this is our group, you've got to make the change?
I think it's dangerous, because how much do you then tell your team that we're concerned about what the other team's doing as opposed to what we're trying to accomplish over here? I think in your head, and I'm sure we'll touch on it through the podcast as well, is you want to make sure whatever your five on the floor or whatever rotation you've got, you want to have certain things on the floor. Like you need enough ball handling, you need enough shooting, you need enough athleticism, enough size, no matter what your rotation is. And I think that's important, no matter how you start, no matter how you rotate through the game, that you're able to address those things that you value as a coach that are going to help you win at the end of the day.
Well, the other thing is, athletes understanding it's probably not who starts, it's who you're playing at the end. I'm sure we'll touch that on as well. But, you know, these are the key indicators that we need you to be able to hit to keep your court time going. If that's not there, well, we can't finish with you. So getting them to think that way versus I need to be a starter, otherwise I can't be effective.
Yep. I know with my groups, I've always liked to have some scoring come off the bench if I can. Like, it's, I don't necessarily start, you know, probably I'm still going to start my best scorers, but if I can have someone that can get hot quickly or get us some points quickly or can be a great defensive stopper quickly, if I can have those guys come off the bench, it's really valuable to have if you need to make a change, and it can sometimes save you a timeout. You don't need to blow that because you've got guys that can come into the game and have an impact straight away.
The Ginobili comparison's a massive one, but the biggest part to that is getting that player to buy into their role.
Yep.
So not just doing it, and you're thinking you're a genius on the sideline, and then the kid's like, well, why am I always coming in and I'm having an impact? Selling that's their asset for the group, part of team cultures, hopefully, you know, it's not who's putting the ball in the hole, it's collectively how we're doing it.
At a domestic level, like Jared Weeks has been pretty good at that in the NBL. And he looks completely invested into, when he does come off the bench, that he is the guy that gives him a spark, scores it. Jamal Crawford's that guy in the NBA. Lou Williams just signed a however many million-dollar deal overnight. Like what Justin said, like the culture is, okay, we need this guy to be, or the girl, to be this person who influences the game. I think that's the biggest part, is if that's how they influence the game, having them believe how much value that brings is important.
Definitely. So, is equal court time a real achievable thing at junior level, I suppose? So if we go right back to the start, is equal court time what we should all be aiming for? Or is this a game where we sort of need to, you know, put up with some knocks? Sometimes you play well and you get more minutes. Sometimes you play poor and you don't. But it's for the good of the team. Should coaches at a junior level be giving equal court time to athletes?
I think for the first three quarters, absolutely. Like, I think no one improves without being in the game. And again, it comes down to what the club's philosophy is. You know, if it's tournament play and the goal is you have to win this tournament, well, then maybe that changes slightly. You can't play everyone equal. But from a seasonal sort of thought process, I don't see any issue in having an equal rotation through those first three quarters. And then the last quarter, well, now we've got to find a way to get it. That doesn't mean that you don't coach with an equal court time rotation. Like, if someone's making the same error, you've got to get them out and coach them on that and then give them a chance to get back in. So having a set rotation doesn't mean that no matter what's going on the floor, that's what we stay with. Like, likewise with timeout usage, with subbing patterns, whatever, you've got to be able to play the game. So, that, you know, in my opinion, I think it could be done, but you've got to just have that overriding sort of thought process.
It has to be a bit of a holistic view, as you say, like, who gets better by sitting? Like, it might win you some more games, but is that really what your job is as a junior development coach? I'd suggest probably not. Right?
Yeah. And what is junior level? Like, dealing with 17-year-olds in an under-18 competition is vastly different from 12-year-olds in an under-14 or even 14-year-olds in an under-16 comp. So what is the junior level that you're responsible for? And figuring out how you're going to aid the development of the athletes the best possible way. So, you know, if you've got a post player in under-14s, playing him 3, 4, 5 minutes, a half or a game is probably not going to help his or her development at all. But figuring out how you can put them on the floor with maybe a strong 4 players or a strong other 3 players who they can potentially have some success with and contribute to the team.
The other part to that, though, is setting athletes up for success. So having them out there on the floor and they're drowning, for better use of a word, out there, because they're in the second unit and they just don't have a skill set that can help, then yeah, maybe you need to look at who you do start and can they be better suited and aid the group better by starting with that stronger core group.
It's a great point. I've seen some coaches use like a plus-minus really effectively in this, because all of a sudden you look at the plus-minus ratio of, you know, player A and they're on the court with 4 weaker players and they also look not that great. But if you look at player B, who's on the floor with the same 4 players, they're also not great. So finding the relationship between having a player who can contribute to a particular unit is really important. Plus-minus ratio is pretty good with that.
And it's a bit of trial and error. Like, you're not going to know straight away, but you can use your training sessions for this as well. And you can find out which groups tend to work better with each other. I mean, your starters might just stand out, obviously, but by the same token, you can find out some of your kids that are traditionally bench players might work really well with that first unit as well, and that's fairly handy to know, especially if you start to get in foul trouble. Do you guys have rules with foul trouble? Like, do you have a rule that if you pick up two in the first half, you're out, and you sit until the second half? Like, do you guys just play it by ear?
I think it's a lot has to do with the player as well. So thinking about my import last year, if he had two fouls, I would quickly hurry to get him out of the floor because I knew a bad offensive over the back wall was coming.
Or a tech
was coming in halfway through the second quarter, which is not helpful. So knowing who your athlete is really important. I think the NBA has helped, and maybe the NBL to a certain degree this year has helped kind of squash the whole, you know, you got two fouls in the second quarter, come sit the rest of the half. And I think you can do stuff or do things as a coach, you know, experimenting with a zone or potentially a matchup that is more favourable to not picking up that third foul to help keep that athlete on the floor.
I think you've got to have a check for yourself, though. Like, say, you know, someone picks up a second foul in the second quarter, that's the checkpoint. All right, do I trust this athlete to make good decisions now? Is there something I can change to keep them out on the floor? No? Okay, now we get them out. The thing in working with Dean Vickerman that's kind of changed my old perspective on it is we just go purely by feel on that and kind of ride it, where to me the value of understanding there's a minute to go in a quarter and being able to get that player out then, so you know they've got their two fouls, you've lived with it for the next 3 minutes, there's a minute on the clock, get them out then, that's probably the part of rotating that you've got to really think about then. So don't put them in a situation where, yep, you've got away with it, great, get them out, let's get through this last minute and then go again.
The player will try to convince you that they're okay.
Always try and convince you. Like,
I'm good, coach, I'm good.
And how many times have you tried to listen and empower the player and it backfires on you? So you've got to go with what your gut tells you on that.
And it does happen a lot where you can sub that player out with two fouls and they finish the game on two fouls. And you've effectively fouled them out for no reason yourself by simply not playing them. So I think gut feel is the way to go.
I have a feel for how the game's being officiated too. A real ticky-touch game being officiated is probably not the one that you want to play in for the next 6 minutes of the second quarter.
But that is, like, you know, I believe coaches need to be able to communicate with referees, and so that is a great time to, I guess, bring awareness. Now, there's a great way to do that and a terrible way to do that. I suggest talking in the manner that we are now, but, you know, the worst thing you can do is kill a player's rhythm. So if they pick up that second foul in the first minute into the second quarter, well, they sit for the next 9 minutes, their rhythm's gone. So, you know, thinking about that, where some players might be great in that situation, you go, yeah, no, I can sit here and I'll come in and I'm making my first shot.
Yep.
How do you deal with players that aren't happy with their own court time? Which can happen a little bit. It doesn't tend to matter too much in sort of the under-12s, under-14s. They're not really too aware of if they're playing a lot or if they're not playing. But what about players, sort of the older age groups, and probably even senior basketball, that feel like they should be playing more? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so the word equality gets used a fair bit, you know, in team environments and that, and everyone is absolutely equal. I think the thing that athletes really need to understand is if you can't make a free throw and you can't defend, we can't play you in the last quarter.
Just like, a free throw?
Well, to me, you know, what happens late game when it's close? You know, like way more fouls are called, people putting you to the line. So if you can't step up and hit that, that's chances are we can't play it. Likewise, if you're a liability on defense, we can't play you either. So they're the two things that every athlete needs to understand, and then that the conversation about court time can come from there. I do believe that team culture needs to be set to a point where it shouldn't be, you know, not rewarding the highest score or, you know, in that aspect of, you know, it's opportunity versus reward. It's got to be more about, okay, what is the team's process? What are we doing? And can you help that? If you're helping that, then you deserve some opportunity to play.
Yeah, and I think for me, so just part of my philosophy, practice and training will dictate a lot of this. How you are in practice and how you train will be a direct reflection of how much court time. Now I'm dealing with older athletes and athletes that are not in the developmental phase, like not 12 to 14, 15. But I've heard of a lot of coaches charting practices. I don't know if it's resource dependent, but you can film practice and go watch the film back. So if you chart a player goes 2 for 19 in practice and blows closeouts in the last, you know, scrimmage 4 or 5 times, that can provide you some, not ammunition, but a little bit of backing as to why you made the certain decision to not play them that much in the second half. So I think as a coach, you want to have some kind of reasoning for your rotations as well. And I think resourcing and film and charting some certain things can help with that as well.
The other part to understand is the best kids get selected.
Yeah.
So there is an element of going away, doing the work and ensuring you're someone that isn't up for discussion. I can never remember which athlete I heard talk about this, but they missed out on something. And they came to the realisation, well, I was in discussions of just making it. I don't want to be that person. I want to be the person that they just tick because I'm one of the best people there. And so then that drove their work ethic for that next period of time. And, you know, we can't all be the best player on the team, but what we can do is be someone that goes away, does the work,
yeah,
and provides a real reason to get opportunity on the court.
Speak for yourself, Justin. Some of us were the best player on the team. I was not one of them, but I'm led to believe that some in the room might have been the best player on their team.
Might have been me. No.
But I think it is healthy for players to be able to talk to you about, like, hey, I want more of an opportunity. I want to play more. And let's face it, every player wants to play. You want to have, be able to have an open and honest discussion with them and say, well, okay, here's why you're not getting the minutes you want. And to be able to point that out, if you lie to them, well, you're not going to really solve the problem.
It goes back to a pod last year with relationships and how important that is.
And role definition.
Yeah, role definition. Yeah. You know, making sure it's really clear, the measurables that are there, you know, like not rewarding the shot that goes in when you're saying you can't be taking contested shots, and then the kid that misses a wide open shot, you're benching him. Like, you've got to be consistent with your messaging, set a standard that's acceptable for all athletes, not just one or two.
With court time comes parents. How do you deal with parents that may be a little disgruntled that their child isn't necessarily playing as much as they should be? I mean, there's a few clubs will have policies around this. Like, I know there are certainly some clubs that will say, hey, don't be talking to the coach straight after the game. That's generally when tensions are fairly high. You don't want to cause more problems. Sit on it for a day and then we'll discuss it. But how would you go about dealing with a parent that might have waited the 24 hours and then come and talk to you about it?
Everyone's looking at me for the answer. All right, I'll start with it. And it's so, I mean, just reflecting on what's gone on in the past, I have heard stories of just this past Australia Day tournament of parents chasing down coaches post-game, and that's 100% not the way to do it. Definitely let the coach either debrief or sleep on it or something, because like you said, your clarity is not right there after the final whistle's blown. I think a conversation around the expectation for the kid, the team, the program, the stage of development, whatever it is, has to take place. I think it's got to be a reasonable conversation. It can't be a, my son, my daughter is this, this and this, and the coach can't come back with, your son, your daughter's just not very good at A, B, C, D. So I think a big part of that is having two adults actually sit down and figure out what has just happened.
To me, it starts before the season.
Yeah, and that's...
So you have to have the conversation about this is what we're trying to achieve, so you can lay that out so no one can say they weren't aware. Talk about, you know, what is your philosophy? Is it equal opportunity? Is it the last quarter? You know, the kids that are getting it done are going to be playing. There is going to be a set starting five. There isn't. Like, just lay it out. The other thing that I think, and I wish I thought about this way back when I was coaching juniors, was then put it in writing, because everyone hears verbalization a little bit differently. So then putting it into a formal document and then refer back to that every time. And in that document, have some rules about if you're seeking feedback, it needs to come the next day in written form, and then we'll catch up at the next practice. Like, I know one of our country clubs does that, and they seem to diffuse a lot of challenges, because by the time that next practice happens, everyone's calmed down a bit. It's a more of a measurable chat.
Yeah.
So I think the real key part's the start of the season, you know, making that ground rule be set.
And I think with basketball being so participatory here in Melbourne, there's a lot of kids and a lot of teams.
You got it out in one hit too.
But there are a lot of teams and a lot of playing, and I'm not sure every team is playing to win the ultimate prize in every division. So there is an awful lot of development or just participation going on. So I think spelling that out before the season, like if we're talking about the under 16, sixth team somewhere, like what is the goal of that team this year? And, you know, you're probably not turning out the top-end talent in the age group that year. So what is the actual goal of Team X this season? I think that can be definitely done.
Like, you know, we're opening a massive amount of worms here, to me, to me, it's also having a realistic understanding of where groups are at. And that's coaching directors as much as it is individual coaches.
Yeah.
And, you know, like before the season, everyone's a gold medal team or, you know, a championship potential team. But the reality is, you know, you should be, as you're going along, you feel where do we really fit? And then it's your job to make them the best team they can be by the end of that season. So that doesn't necessarily mean winning it, but as long as they progress through it, everyone's pretty happy.
Yeah. And I think when dealing with parents as well, it's really important you don't discuss other people's children. If they come to you and say, hey, my child is not getting minutes, but player X over there is getting a heap of minutes, how come they get more? It's not about their child. But you need to make it about that parent that is talking to you and don't be discussing someone else.
And those heated conversations where it does come at you.
Yep.
So I'm more than happy to talk about your child.
Yep.
No one else is.
No one else.
You know, so... But the other part, I think, for coaches and administrators, anyone in the sport, it becomes a little bit defensive sometimes with parents. And this took me a while to figure out, but my thought process around it is their child's their most important thing in their life. So respect that, understand that, and then come from that angle versus what do they know? Like the second you get your back up, you're not really going to help the situation. You're just going to add fire to the situation. So just trying to remember that. And then, you know, again, if you've got those dot points that this is our criteria or this is what we laid out, that's going to help that chat every time.
I think it's always helpful to have a neutral party in as well. If you are talking to parents about court time, which is usually a fairly sensitive topic, just to have either your director of coaching, a team manager, or someone that's a fairly neutral party involved in that discussion, just so you don't get to the point where that's not what we've discussed, or they said this in their meeting, and it's reflective of that. I think it's really helpful.
Just put it in writing. Straight away, it's almost like minutes of a meeting. You've got to just get that through and copy your coaching director in, and so then everyone's on the same page.
Writing the hot hand. Do you, don't you? So you've had a player that's just stuck three threes in a row, but they're due to come out and they are gassing. How often would you ride that hot hand and say, nah, bad luck, we're running another play to get you a 4-3 if we can? If you had that sub loaded at the bench already and they were supposed to come out and they just catch fire, like, would you still sub them out, or are you just going to ride that thing and see how you go?
If he knows that sub's coming for him, he's going to get the fourth one up anyway. So.
I mean, you feed the fire, absolutely, but there's a difference between, you've got called the sub, the guy's meant to come out, and then they stick a three and then you change your mind. Like, you had them rotating for a reason. I think if someone's just gone 3-for-3, absolutely, I'm running something to try and get 4-for-4. You know, that's just my belief in around that. Like, I think old school basketball is very much around go to the well and keep feeding the fire. And I think modern day basketball is a lot more equal opportunity in the way we play. But that element still really matters. You know, if someone's got the hot hand, the thing that frustrates me, and we talk to our coaches about it, is if you were going to sub someone out and then something happens on the floor, there was a reason you were going to sub them out. Likewise, there was a reason you were going to call a timeout. Now that you just made a bucket, doesn't change what your reason was. So stay consistent with your thought process and then your messaging to keep making changes in the direction you need it to go.
Yeah, I agree. I think the hot hand's the hot hand. And in a game, like, someone who can make a couple of consecutive shots can actually change the course of that game. So keeping that in mind, if you are, just backing on what Justin said, if you are going to get that player out for a reason, they probably still need to come out of the game. Even if it is disciplinary, if it's they're just fatigued, whatever it is, there probably is a reason. So trust yourself that that is the rotation. That's something that I take from the NBA game. I think they do it based on the length of their season. Like, they play a long season. The BJBL season is also a long season, so that might also play
almost 82 games.
But they bring players out even if they have the hot hand. Like, the 6-minute rotation, you play the first 6 minutes of the first quarter and you come out. You come out of that second media with 9 minutes gone in the first quarter. You come out, you go back in the second quarter, and you play out. So I think rotation, knowing what your rotation is in your head or on your chart, on the bench, just gives you a bit of clarity as a coach, because now you're not clutching for a reason, or, you know, what's my sub pattern.
The other one is you're not winning games in the first quarter, so you know you've got to be careful not to cook someone too early and stretch it too long. But yeah, I think there's definitely opportunity there to find a way to keep it consistent.
So how do you deal with an athlete that you might sub into the game? They come in and they are just bad straight up. Like, they go turnover, missed shot, turnover, defensive, blown closeout, and you've just had enough. In 40 seconds, they've made monumental errors. Do you let them ride it out, or do you just sub them out and say, hey,
drag,
we need to have a chat?
Drag them.
It's mike.zeppel@basketballvictoria.com.au for your complaints.
Developmental versus what are we actually trying to do again? So I'm dealing with a 12-year-old girl on a Friday night, and she kicks the ball out of court three times. It might be, hey, you're okay, like, you're still good, I'm not going to take you out. She needs to probably understand that. Quarter time might be a good chance for you to get to her and have a quick chat. You might need a timeout just to relax everyone and just relax her. Because I watch games on Friday nights and you see that. And the first person that feels bad is the kid. The kid's not trying to turn it over or throw the ball out of court. So I think the dragging of them would actually compound the problem or the issue that they've had. If we're talking about, you know, Thursday night at an under-18s AJC and it's a quarterfinal game, might be a little bit different. Two turnovers or an offensive foul and a turnover because, you know, the athlete might just not be in the right headspace, or they're just a little nervous. Like, you do have to read that as well. So I think there's two very distinct ways to look at it, just depending on the team and what your pulse is for the athletes.
For me, it's part of your coaching philosophy. So in my head, there's positive turnovers and there's turnovers. So has the athlete tried to achieve what we're hoping to get done? It doesn't work out and there's a turnover. That's a very big difference to just making a decision that isn't part of who we are. The other thing, though, is part of my coaching philosophy, and I spill this out to athletes at the start of every season. You'll get the opportunity. You can make an error. You can't make two errors. Two errors tells me you're not getting enough oxygen to your brain, so that means we've got to sub out, have a quick spell, think about it, and then move on. But that's been my consistency for a long time now, and what it does is, one, you're backing the athlete. So you're backing the athlete that, yep, you made an error, but you're going to rectify that on the next play, or you're going to make sure that you make change on that. If you don't, then you know that we've already discussed this, you're coming out, and we'll talk about the finer points and what we've got to do better. Just again, that ability to have some consistency and go back one level. If the parents knew that, I don't know that they can then come argue if their kid keeps coming in every time, they make two errors in a row and you've already spelled that out. So there's little levels of that. I am a little bit different than what Zep said there, and that I think that's for every level. And like, I've used that at every level where, you know, the worst part is when you see coaches with bench players have different roles with starters. So to me, you know, the amount of times you watch a bench guy come in, make a turnover straight away, or miss a shot and they're ripped back out. Like, that to me, well, you're just killing that athlete and you're also not making them have the opportunity to help us. Versus the starter that makes four turnovers and we're still going. So
every game.
Yeah, so just making sure there's that consistency, I think, is really important. And that helps your team culture as well. That if everyone's on that same kind of equal opportunity part there, then
I think the caveat on all this is effort.
Yeah.
Like, so a player that gets subbed in or just starts the game and is not demonstrating effort or playing hard, then I think that's a completely different thing. So there's a good saying, you know, the bench is a great teacher, the bench might be the best teacher of all. They might need to sit, and the conversation might need to go like, you're just not playing hard enough, and I can't put you in the game if you're not playing hard enough, because the other guys or the other girls will play hard. So I think that's the big difference between the turnovers and actually just playing hard.
The other part with starters and bench, I know we did this with the 20s group, the second team we picked up last year or the year before now. We sold it as the position had to achieve this.
Mm.
So we had 10 guys, we were playing everyone, we kind of said that changed as the league went on, absolutely, but it was our centres needed to get this done. Our wings needed to get this done. Our guards needed to get this done. So even as they were rotating in, they became a bit teamy about what they had to achieve as a group. And it was the cool part about that. I mean, we did way better than what we probably thought we would at the start of the week, but the really cool part about it was how much those boys were helping each other and supporting each other when the other one was on the floor. So I think there's a number of different ways you can make court time not be a real factor. It's about what you're trying to achieve on the floor.
And you can get your players to buy in with like that bench mentality as well. Like I know I've done it with some of the teams I've coached in the past where my bench group, so to speak, is my pressing group. And they buy in and they feed on that. It's like, hey, when we all check in at the same time, we're up the floor, we're going to try and cause some chaos.
Yep.
And that's their thing. And they buy
in. You see that in the NBL this year, there's definitely lineups where teams will put them in. You know what's coming because that they know that that's the strength of that group coming in. And it is a challenge to deal with that. You know, like it's coming, but they're elite at it, so you're still going to be able to negate that and rectify it.
I think one of the big things too is how you deal with a player that you have had to sum out. Like when they have made errors, what you do with that player? Do you send them down the end of the bench to write? Do you give them the spray as they come off? Like, or do you just go ultra positive with them? Like, I know there are certainly times I've been guilty of giving some big sprays to players coming out. I do apologise to any athletes that may be listening to this. But there have been times where it's like, hey, we've discussed this multiple times. You need to hear it. Bad luck. And there are other times where it's like, well, you know what? You're playing almost in fear.
Yeah.
That can be on a lot of different levels. That could be because parental pressure, that could be game pressure, that could be coach pressure. What you do with them when they come out can make a massive difference to those athletes too.
Yeah. I'm probably ultra positive in the way that I deal with athletes and deal with situations. The two things that will have me go offside is effort. Like I can be ultra positive, but if you're not playing hard, then this is not going to work at all and you will just sit here. And the other one is if we've gone through a scouting report and a walkthrough, and you know what your job is to track this side on ball. And if you can't get that done, then tonight I can't get my job done to get you in the game. So I think there's a few ways to look at it. I'm ultra positive with the mistake, the positive turnover, trying to make a play. They want to make a play, want to make a contribution. But the effort and doing your job, I think, is a bit non-negotiable for me.
Yeah, but like direct feedback shouldn't be viewed as a negative. Like, that's what our job is. We've got to make the whole team better and individuals better within that. Definitely, I would never make it about an individual and spray them on that front. But if it is a non-negotiable of the team, which is effort, accountability on scout, those sorts of things, then they need to be told pretty pointed. I think I'm probably more the positive side of things as well and that. But the best compliment I've received is the consistency with everyone. Like everyone gets the same spray if they're not, there's not a pecking order within it. And I think if you can get to that level with athletes, that really helps them buy in the other way. But if I'm, chewing out Zep because he's not doing what he should, getting over the screen, and then you go underneath and I don't say anything to you, he's going to start thinking, well, I'm a prick.
And that's when you get to say the better player doesn't need to get touched on that.
And then whereas...
Let me go on
then. Whereas, if that's a team rule and the consistency delivery of message is there, I think everyone can buy into that a little bit better.
And you hear about just two American coaches like Coach Popovich and Coach Belichick. That's kind of what comes out of their camps the most is they'll give player number one a spray, they'll give player number 53 a spray about the exact same thing. And it just creates buy-in and the rest of the roster just understands that, look, this is fair game, we're just trying to...
The other thing, though, that frustrates me is that word spray, as if that's like a coaching right and a cool part of coaching. It's actually...
It's not.
It should never be a spray. Right. Like, it should be direct instruction that makes that athlete better and the team better.
Teaching.
Spray in my head is when people try and make it personal, calling you a so-and-so, like... That stuff. Leave that in America. Like, those coaches can continue to be great coaches, in my opinion, because they live off that. Like, our culture is help our mates out, and that needs to come across in the coaching, I think. So, the spray, direct, I really love the word, direct coaching. It's like, I'm going to let you know what you missed out on, but it won't be personal.
$10 word when a 10 cent word will probably do there, but I don't mind that. I did read an article not too long ago that most coaching sprays are more for the crowd than anything else. It's more to let people know that, hey, the mistakes that are happening are not on the coach, it's on the players.
Think about the kid that shoots the ball and the ball slips out of his hands or whatever, he looks at his hands. Now, is that really about them and the team?
Deflecting.
Or is it, like, oh, it's someone else's fault? That, I 100% agree that's coaches as well. Like, you see the coaches going off, and so what are you achieving right now?
Yep.
I know one thing we discussed it, something I was involved in on the weekend, but the pushing and pulling of the information to athletes. Like, you can push the information, you can talk at them and say, this is what's going on, or you can try and pull the information from them, and what are you seeing? And as a coach, there are plenty of times where what we think is going on isn't necessarily what's going on, because what's on the court and what the player sees is totally different. They can sit there and they can say, hey, I know where that wing defender's playing, we have to do this, whereas on the sidelines it can look vastly different. Like, it's...
Absolutely. One of the things I love that Vico does is, in video, ask the guys what they think. And, like, that players will always see stuff, feel stuff, different to what we see it as coaches from the sideline. And that's a really important skill to be able to have that. Like, it's good to hear. It'd be good to hear about your weekend in many ways, mate.
We might save that for another podcast rather than this one, but... Anything else in terms of managing a bench that you guys can think of that we haven't touched on as yet?
The one thing I'd like to bring up is set rotations that Zep touched on earlier. I think coaching is about setting players up for success so the team can have success. You've got to figure out within your group, if we have a set rotation and they understand they're coming in midway through the quarter, they're going to see out the quarter, they can be more confident about, you know, what they're doing on the floor. I've found that's been way more successful than when you're doing things at hop. And so pre-game, I'll have a little rotation plan in my head. That doesn't mean it survives, like, things happen, but the athlete's knowing, yep, I've got a 3-minute burst here, my effort levels can be super high, I know what I'm doing. I think that just helps.
Mm-hmm. And how does that tie into the role that they play for the team? So, and you'll use the example about turning it up defensively, or if you've got a really athletic post player who now you can trap on more screens with, how do you come into the game? You know you're going to get in towards the end of the first quarter. You know at the end of the first quarter we're going to trap all these ball screens because you're on the floor and you're the man or you're the girl that does that job for us. How does that play into your contribution to the success of the team? So I think that, and players, everyone likes routine. Like, if I know I'm coming into the game and I know that I'm going to be the tracking ball defender, or I know I'm the catch and shoot three guy, athletes like routine. I think that helps them, and like Justin said, like, set them up for some success, and that's certainly a really good way to do it.
Yep. Probably the last thing I actually forgot about, offensive and defensive subs down the stretch. Big believer, you just go best five and bad luck. Will you sub in guys to do a certain role for one possession and get them back out again, and how do you sell that to the players?
It's pretty strategic, Robbie.
Not something I'm dealing with much at the moment, in fairness. It is just whoever's catching at the time plays.
I think that's a game-by-game scenario. I definitely ask my assistants who's getting that dunk. So we will look at, for the last quarter or the last five, what is our best lineup, what's been the best defensive lineup, what's been the best offensive lineup, and whatever we need more of, maybe that's the way it goes. Defensive offensive subbing is something you can use in close games. If you're all getting blown out, there's no point on it. So, I think there's avenues for all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, before the year last year, before our big V year, we caught up the coaching staff and had them all write down who they thought was their best shooting lineup, their best defensive lineup, and their most athletic lineup.
Yep.
I think it's a good idea to have an idea of what those lineups are.
Purely eye test, or did you use data on that?
A bit of both.
Yeah,
a bit of both. So we could use shooting percentages to do it at the 3-point or best shooting lineup.
Yeah.
Athletically, was a bit of an eye test.
Yep.
We can get it done at the big V level. There's not that many good athletes in the big V, mate. we had not many good athletes. And just knowing that, okay, we're down 6 with 1:30 to go, we've probably got to speed it up. Who's our athletic lineup? Hopefully you've got enough good shooting in that athletic lineup, and same defensively.
Just a reminder, if you do have any questions or any topics you'd like us to talk about, please do send them through via email, or you can grab us on Twitter at some point and we'll discuss it there. So probably the new portion of the podcast we're going down
Tech
to.
Tech Foul didn't last long.
It's still there. It's just been renamed.
Rebranded. Like this pod.
Exactly. It only took us like 2 weeks, I think it was.
It'll be good by 2020.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know when lasting until 2020, unfortunately, but we'll see how we play out. So the last portion of our show is the split, the kick, and the extra. So effectively, we're going to start with the split. We're going to come up with a topic. We're going to give Justin and Mike a minute to come up with their argument. One will get a pro and one will get a con.
A minute each.
Debate.
You can go 30 seconds if you like.
Were you ever a good debater?
Didn't do much of it, mate.
I feel like there's a boom-tish sound effect that needs to come with this. So our topic this week, big kids in junior basketball can only play in the post. Justin, you have the negative. You think they should be able to play everywhere?
Yes.
Zeb, you have the positive, that they need to go and master that skill set down in the low block first before they can go and play anywhere else.
Good.
Excellent.
Good. Who are you going to start with?
Let's go with Justin. I feel like his job might be slightly easier on this one.
Slightly easier?
I'd like to think slightly easier.
Are we having a real clock, or is this like a fantasy 60 seconds, mate? Because we did cop negative feedback on our 24-second shot
did.
Clock.
This is a real clock.
For a minute, so.
I promise you, this is a real clock. The iPhone is out. We are on. Hit it.
I don't know how anyone can dictate what position a player is going to be at a junior level. So, therefore, I feel there is a responsibility that the big kid that's coming through, that you're able to aid them in other parts of the game. The international game right now has a lead post and a trail post, and you need to be able to play in both. So even if they do stay as a tool, they definitely need to be able to have skill sets that include shooting the ball, being able to play off the bounce, and decision-making at that point in time. So for me, there is no strength in just pigeonholing someone, and not just post players, any players, into that one specific spot. I don't need the rest of the time, Zep. I'm going to leave it there.
Whack. Cop that. All right. So, Zep, you've had some time to think about this.
Noted.
You good?
I'm good, mate. I do think that... I accept your argument, mate. Very well done. But I do think that if you are a big kid at 13, 14, 15 years of age, for you to be successful in the future, you will have to have mastered a pretty simple package of catching, drop stepping, finishing, and shooting on rhythm or shooting in rhythm from a certain range. Now, the rest of it can come, and it will come as you develop and get better, but for you to be a really good player, even in the future, you will have to be able to master a handful of things. And if you do master those things, then great, we can work on some other things. But I have seen it go the other way, where you do get a post player as an under 16 player who does not master the package or the jump hook, the drop step, whatever it works out to be, and they can't actually get to the next part of development. So I do understand the multi-skilled and multi-faceted.
8 seconds, mate.
I've gone for nearly 60 seconds. I've done well. But yeah, you got to be able to jump hook it, man. Can't jump hook it, can't play.
That's all that matters. This is not for me to decide. So we are going to get the podcast listeners to vote in on this with hashtag Team Mike or hashtag Team Justin, and they can decide who's won that round. So the next part, that is the split.
How many times can we do it ourselves?
You're going to vote. Yeah, I'm not filtering out anything, so best of luck to you. So the next part is the kick. So Mike, this is your wheelhouse. That is you this week. Justin had a crack last week.
And the kick is now what was the tech foul.
So Mike, what have you got in the crossbar?
Rest in peace, tech foul.
Just quickly, the kick this week is going to come from the under 20 Nationals up in Gosford at the moment. Just the shooting percentages. I'm not going to label anyone, but 3-point shooting percentages on the girls' side, 23%. On the boys' side, 26%. Foul shooting percentages, 57-65. I know it's going to go north later in the week, but across the first 2 days, not great up there. Close the doors, might be a little drafty.
And we should say it is hard to judge when we're not in the building. What straight away that comes to my thought process is, is it system related? You know, like we're just not getting rhythm shots. The free throws is really alarming. Like, and people have heard me say this on the podcast internationally, the two shots that matter most is the 3-point shot and the free throw. And for this to be our under 20s, we've got some of our best athletes up there for sure at the minute on both the boys and girls. Mm. Hopefully, we do start seeing that trend upwards and we get to a point where, you know, that thing gets. Good hoop. Looks like good hoop at the end of the week.
Good, right.
What would you be expecting kids to shoot at the foul line by the time they hit under 20s? Like, what percentage are we talking here?
From the foul line?
Yeah. 80, I'd love to say
80%. I've got
80%. Yeah, 80%. Though. Like, you know, in pressure situations or that, I think 80%. You know, our expectation from a Crocs level and the standard we want to set is it's 90%. And the thought is if you're aiming for that, you're going to get close to that. to be at, like, on the boys, 65% right now, and some of the teams are, like, horrendous. Like, there was one, you know, 8 of 20 or something. Like, you know, that's concerning.
It'll cost you again.
And they'll definitely cost games later in the week. From the three-point line, you know, like, 30% as a minimum, 40% is the goal. So, you know, as a team, I don't know, like 23% in the girls there, that's a fair way off. Doesn't sound like it, but it is 26%. I mean, the volume of shots the boys have put up from the three is more. But, you know, we'll eventually see if that trend changes.
Yeah. And probably has a little bit of an impact on our team zoning. Are they fouling late in games as well? Like, we've obviously touched on it already.
How it's officiated. And
yeah,
that.
Absolutely. It makes a difference.
The one thing I should say, like, I've taken this data now for a number of years, and the one thing that just doesn't improve is our free throw shooting as a nation. And, you know, I think that comes down to team prep and how we prep our teams, and that we don't probably touch on it at any given point. And then we're frustrated in the tournament when, you know, we're losing games because of free throws. You know, like the Vic boys dropped one yesterday. I haven't checked the free throw box score there, but I know we didn't shoot the ball that well from three. So, you know, those things, those two areas constantly become the point of difference in tournament play.
Yep. That's the negative part. Now we've got the extra. So this is the good part of the where we've seen something during the week that we loved. Justin, what have you got?
So I'm sure everyone by now has seen the, you know, the beautiful game clip of the Spurs and the ball movement and just the beauty that has in the game. This week, Utah versus Phoenix. Joe Ingles wasn't featured in the clip, but keep it going, Joe. You're doing well. 8 passes, 5 dribbles, and we're going to put it up on our Twitter feed and the link to the pod. Go have a look at it. It is beautiful basketball. The amount of long closeouts that were forced, the extra pass, penetrating with a purpose and finishing with a dunk, that's how our game should be played. So check it out. It was a very good extra.
I like that. That's it for us for this part of this week. Again, we've got Ian Dunican coming up for the second half of this pod.
Can't wait to hear it.
Says a lot of words that I don't understand. In fairness, like he does get a bit scientific, but it is a great listen to how we can be better at managing our own sleep with ourselves as coaches and also with our athletes as well. So it is definitely a good listen. And
before you wrap it up, though, mate, quick snapshot on your weekend. Tell us what you were in and the FIBA course that you were doing.
So I was doing a FIBA instructors course up in Canberra over the weekend. Very lucky to be involved in that with plenty of good minds. I say this very openly. I walked in there to start off with and thought, why have you got me here? There are so many smarter people in which case, thanks to you guys for getting me involved with that. But yeah, so a little bit in terms of how to be better instructors when you're taking coaching courses. So looking at body language, how you deliver, how to ask questions, those sorts of things as well. So I'll put some notes together on that, and I'll shoot them out by Twitter as well.
Came into Canberra to run that?
They did. So we had Pat Hunt, Pete Lonigan, Michael Haynes, and Nelson Isley that were there to run the course, and a fairly prestigious group of coaches that were in there as well.
To observe some elite coaching as well.
We did. Nate Cooper Brown was really good, I thought, as a part of that under 17s camp, and we saw the NBA Global Academy coach as well. So it was great from our end to sort of have a little bit of a look at that, as well as just a little bit of personal development for ourselves as well. And so there's plenty of things I took out of it. Very grateful for the opportunity, like I said, to be involved in that. I'll get that information out to everyone fairly soon. Probably one thing that I probably have forgotten is the BA Coaches Conference is coming up fairly soon. Yeah, so if you can get along to that, I strongly recommend it. It's you guys were there last year, yep.
Last 2 years, really worthwhile. A lot of good speakers, something for everyone. You may not love it all, but you'll definitely love something there, and just an awesome networking opportunity. The amount of coaches I stay in touch with that hit me up from that, really good.
Yeah, really
good. Worthwhile.
First week in May.
And again, we'll get those dates out to everyone and stay in touch with your clubs, because hopefully they'll push that out as well. That is it for us. We'll be back next week. Good luck with everyone's coaching. For the second half of this week's podcast, I'm with Ian Dunican, who has a long and extensive background in sleep, but I'll let Ian talk a little bit more about his background and the work he does in the sporting world.
Thanks, Rob. So as you say, my name is Ian Dunican. My background is a combination of operational military experience. From there, then I moved into mining and then into consulting. And when I talk about mining, we're talking about actual mining engineer type work, you know, working across these big machines that drag dirt out of the ground. And so for many listeners, they'd be like, well, what's that guy talking about sleep for? And so for about 10 years working at mining company, I was involved heavily in what we call health and safety work. And particularly, I had an interest around human performance, which incorporates fatigue and wellness of the workforce. Before I left that organization I was working for, I ended up being the global advisor for what we call human performance. So I would basically travel around the world working with that company to optimize shifts and rosters, fly in, fly out, whether it be, you know, how to operate on that site to enable productivity, how to do it safely, comply with local legislation. And that could be a combination of mining operations, processing, rail, shipping, to sales and marketing and executives. So kind of doing that human performance across all of those different areas. From there, I moved on to do my PhD at the University of Western Australia. Now, I did that in conjunction with a few organizations, one being the Australian Institute of Sport. I worked at the Combat Sports Centre, mainly because I had the operational military background, and I also like to practice Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And I also like to do a few ultra-running events as well. So I like to put my body through a bit of heartache to figure out my own sleep strategies. I also worked with the now, I suppose, I don't want to say defunct, but I suppose they are defunct or gone, Super Rugby team Western Force. Some people might say they're called the Melbourne Rebels now, seeing as half of them are over here in Melbourne. And I also worked then with the Perth Lynx in WA as well. And so I kind of had a lot of studies across all of those areas. I just recently finished my PhD before Christmas. And now I'm doing consulting work back into industry and also elite athletic organisations or individuals. So it's kind of a quick, brief overview.
It's very brief, as you can tell. That's a very thick Irish accent as well to go with it. And I will not make fun of you on it, given your length of time in jiu-jitsu and ultramarathon running. I'm certainly not getting out of here anytime soon. So,
well, my dad says I sound Australian now because I've been 15 years in Australia and he thinks I sound very Australian. So, but I think... maybe he needs to sober up and listen to really what I sound like.
completely understand it. So when we're talking sleep in athletes, that's obviously a really important part of what we do as coaches. When sleep suffers, so that could be the quantity, that could also be the quality. What are the first things that will start to fall apart for athletes in their world, I suppose?
Yeah, interesting. So what we see is there's two ways to look at poor sleep. We call this acute and chronic, or short-term and long-term. And so for athletes in the long-term, as they get older, this may lead to more injury, more illness, basically a general feeling of fatigue, being tired, inability to perform at the highest levels. In the short-term, what we see after diminished or reduced sleep is we generally see the first thing to go is an effect on cognition. And so cognitive performance is really what becomes impaired, first of all. Now, the scientific literature will be a little bit divided on the time frame, and it depends on the athlete, and it depends on a number of factors, because when we talk about sleep, it is a biological kind of component, and it's not like physics or hard sciences where we kind of have inputs and then therefore we get these outputs, and everybody's very different, so we have a lot of individual variability when it comes to sleep. So for some people, we will see cognitive performance can be affected within the first 24 hours of a bad night's sleep, or if you have a number of bad nights sleep, then you'll have cognitive performance being affected. And physical performance can be affected after 72 hours. And when I talk about physical performance, I'm talking about strength, cardiovascular output, muscular endurance, these type of things. But again, it can be sport specific, depends on the hours of wake prior to the testing or the event. And also what's really important is how much sleep the athlete got in the last 8 hours or last night, 24, 48 and 72. So you have this kind of cumulative effects if you're a bad sleeper. All these things line up.
When we start talking about a recovery time for an athlete, when does recovery time start in the sleep world, I suppose? Like straight after an event, they're probably all wired up and, you know, still very highly aroused, I would suggest. When do they need to start thinking about their sleep before their next event? So if they're playing a tournament where they have a game a day, how is that going to impact that on?
So that's an interesting question about preparation for a game and then recovery, and where do you draw the line? And it's going to be sports specific. So in elite rugby union, where you have a game every week or you have a bye week, you kind of have this definitive line in the sand. You can put, you know, sort of midweek. So if you play a game on a Saturday night, you can have recovery on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and then you kind of get into pre-game strategy Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, for example. Now, the challenge arises in basketball with these double headers. and it gets really difficult. And it gets difficult if they're at home, it's one thing, and then if they're traveling, it's another thing as well, particularly if they've got to travel the next day as well. So I would say in basketball, and from the work we did in the WNBL with the Perth Lynx, I would say from the moment that sort of the game is finished, you do your cool down, you do some stretching, whatever sort of recovery modality you have in terms of like rehab after the game, stretching, foam rolling, you have a meal. From then, if it's a doubleheader, the focus should be on recovery. So it's nearly like there's the muscular recovery, if you want to call it that, straight away after the game. And then there's a sleep for recovery for the next day straight away. And so your strategy should be about promoting sleep as quickly as possible after a game. Now, this kind of leads into another part about what should you do in preparation for those type of events so you can promote the sleep. And so what we would start with, first of all, is caffeine. So it's one of the biggest opportunities for improvement, I think, in athletes today. So caffeine generally isn't tested, or it's legal, or they can kind of use it as they wish. But that brings with it a whole host of problems, because caffeine then is not used strategically. Or we have athletes, particularly male athletes, taking a lot of pre-workout, and then athletes don't realize the source of the caffeine. And the caffeine then will affect the recovery and sleep. So a lot of people take caffeine, pre-workout drinks, coffee, no-dose tablets, whatever it might be, for performance as an ergogenic aid, right? So it'll take, at 5 o'clock, the game's at 6. But the problem is, caffeine takes roughly an hour to peak in a system. Then when it peaks, it's a four-hour half-life. And so if you take it at, 5 o'clock, peaks at 6, you play your game, it's not going to be out of the system until at least 10 o'clock. So you can't even start trying to initiate sleep until 10 o'clock. Now, you think that's a kind of a fairly benign, easy example to use. At WNBL games, sometimes half 7 at night. Yep. By the time sort of, you know, they take caffeine, they get on the court, they play the game's over, meet and greets, pitchers, signing, media, recovery, meal. It could be 12 o'clock at night. And the caffeine is just starting to come out of their system. So when you start looking at caffeine and then post-game media commitments, it can be very hard for those athletes to achieve sleep afterwards. So we've got to look first at the pre-game strategy before we look at the post-game strategy. So timing of caffeine for me is an interesting one.
So what time would you sort of recommend? I know players that are religiously, they'll drink a Red Bull before a game because they sort of feel like that gets them ready for it. I know coaches that will sit there with a Coke and coach the game out. And so consequently, they're wired to the nth degree afterwards. What sort of timing would you recommend if you're looking at pre-game to actually have caffeine so that it won't impact you post-game?
So I think it will vary between sort of 30 minutes to about 90 minutes for each individual athlete. Probably want to play around with this in maybe training to see when you feel like it's kind of kicking in. There is there is tests you can do to figure out your tolerance to caffeine or how quickly you absorb it. But like with all tests, it costs some money. On average, I would say if you go with 60 minutes, you should be okay. So if the game's tipping off at 7:30, you won't be taking it about 6:30. Now, the other thing I'd say as well is consuming caffeine at halftime is not going to give you much of a benefit. Because again, when that kicks in, it's going to be later on. So consume your caffeine before the game. And if you want to consume your last bit of caffeine, maybe just before you go on the court. But consuming caffeine at halftime or during the game is not going to give you any benefit in terms of performance. Now we're actually in hampering recovery. And we found that in Super Rugby. And we had a paper accepted in the European Journal of Sports Science, which actually showed that. And so some of these players, when they played between 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock at night in Super Rugby, weren't going to bed until at least 2:30 in the morning. Some guys weren't going to bed as late as 8 o'clock the next morning. And 4 out of the 23 players didn't even sleep after the game because they were so wired from the game and caffeine.
It's incredible when you sort of look at the amount of recovery that's required. In particular, Super Rugby is probably a little bit of an anomaly given the amount of travel is involved with that. And especially with the Perth Lynx as well. I mean, the WNBL season, obviously, there's a lot of travel involved with that. And that might be a case of you fly in from Perth, play a game in Melbourne, drive up the road to Bendigo, from Bendigo into Sydney, and then back to Perth. That can take a massive toll on the body. So how do you guys manage exactly how they get to sleep on the road in cases like that? Do you, do you try and get them to sleep straight away, or do you just sort of wait it out and say, well, when you are tired, you will fall asleep?
So the first thing we do as geeky scientists is, instead of just making an intervention or recommending something, we actually look at the data. So when we worked at the Perth Lynx, we kind of divided the season into two halves, and we said for the first 6 to 8 weeks, what we're going to do is we're going to monitor the sleep. So we used a wrist actigraphy device called a Rediband, which I validated in the laboratory against polysomnography, which is the gold standard for measuring sleep. The Fatigue Science Rediband has been used by the Seattle Seahawks, Western Force, now being used by the Wallabies. We use that GWS, used by the Chicago Cubs. So a lot of elite athletes have used this device, which is really good. It's been used in mining, and it can predict performance as well with its proprietary algorithm. So we got the baseline with sleep. In addition, then, we use something that many people will not be aware of, what's called biomathematical modelling.
Yep, I've got nothing for you there.
Got nothing for me there. All right. So biomathematical modelling is basically a modelling software where we can input a number of variables related to geographical location, because this then quantifies or gives us the light and dark cycle. Then we can put in the sleep that we collected, or the sleep measures that we collected from the wrist activity monitors. We can also put in training times, travel times. We can also allow for circadian variation. So if you fly from Perth to Melbourne through waypoints. And then from that, then we can make a prediction on performance or effectiveness. So related to human performance. And so that's on a scale of 0 to 100. And to give your listeners an idea, if you're at 77%, that means that your reaction time would be impaired or reduced, or not reduced to get better, but reduced to get worse, to the equivalent of a blood alcohol concentrate of 0.05. And at 70%, it's like being 0.08%. So we can use this modelling to kind of predict performance and what it may be, or we can retrospectively look back across the season and go, our performance on game night at 7 o'clock in Bendigo was 72%. In the first half, and in the second half, it was like 61%. No wonder we dropped 50 points in that. And you can really get down, you can get down to 15-minute increments. So for basketball, it's perfect. You get down to quarters and look at the performance. And with the watches, with the proprietary algorithm, you can actually look at performance variation between each individual player. So you can go, well, player number one was at 70%, player number 10 was at 99% the whole time. So we can work around those variables. So we get all that data. We talk to the coaches as well about how they think the players performed, where they're sitting relative on the table. And so we get all that data together. Then we meet with each individual player. We present back their own individual information. We ask them how they felt. Was it better or worse than normally? And then to improve sleep, we give everybody individual recommendations for their sleep. Now from that then, we came back together as a group and we did a sleep education session for approximately 2 to 3 hours. And so everybody then kind of shared as well, voluntarily, shared their experience. And we spoke to Ian, and Ian said about when we travel east, we should wear this and we should do that. And so everybody had their own individual strategy to improve sleep. And so going into the second half of the season, those strategies were effectively utilized. And we had a lot of media around that. And if you go to my website, sleepforperformance.com.au, you can see a little video clip there highlighting that work that we did with the Perth Lynx. And that season as well, we had a number of those players get into the female, is it the Opals?
Opals.
Yep. Sorry, excuse me. Sometimes I go around so many sports, I forget. such a luxury dealing with all these different athletes, but I forget sometimes. So we use that data then to drive that improvement. Unfortunately, the Lynx finished second in that year, but it was quite a good year.
Yeah, most definitely. And I think a lot of the validation that goes from the fact that players were actually able to be on court and performing at their best. And that's really, as coaches, what we're after. We're after players that can make good decisions under pressure, but can also not be injured all the time. And I suppose one of the problems of our sport is that it's such a big sport, but there's so very few facilities that a lot of athletes end up playing their game at 11 p.m. at night, or they're finishing their game at 11 p.m. at night. They get home, they wake up the next morning, and at 8:30 they're back on court again. So we are hurting our athletes a little bit because of that. Are there any sort of recommendations you can think of that could help our athletes in that sort of a situation where they have the late night and the early morning, that they can just help their bodies a little bit and their minds, I suppose?
Yeah, the first thing I'm going to do here is I'm going to fire some muck at the organisation, because I think the fault actually lies with the WNBL or the NBL, because if you design it like that, it's very hard to get effective performance, right? And so when we look at fatigue risk management in mining or applied settings, we break it into two categories, and it's called organizational responsibility and individual responsibility. So if the league is designed to schedule it in such a manner, it's very hard then for the individual athletes or the teams. So it's very difficult. Like, for example, when I was with the Lynx and you had a team coming from the East Coast and it was an evening game, we would have an advantage, especially at this time of the year with a 3-hour time difference, because the game starts at like 8 o'clock, but it's 11 o'clock, and we would know that by the second half from our modelling work, from what we were doing and what they were doing, we would know that we would have this kind of natural circadian advantage, you know, going into the second half. And we often saw that. We often saw that the home team, due to the time difference, actually performed a lot better. And you actually see that in Super Rugby. Sometimes when teams come from New Zealand, the bigger time difference, the Western Force have upset some of the top teams out in New Zealand. And I think it's due to that travel. So that's, first of all, I'd say there is some accountability that lies with the organisation. For the teams and the individuals, I think it's really looking, like I said, at the pre-game strategy around caffeine, but also trying to get the optimal sleep environment as quickly as possible. So that may mean to the athletes, the minute you finish the game and all your commitments are done, not being on social media, not looking at electronic devices. And it's not so much the exposure. I think it's the stimulating activity, yep, responding to messages, looking at Facebook, what was said about the game, what was about my performance. Just leave it alone. Yep. If you're going to use it maybe for listening to something like a Brain FM or some relaxing music, whatever kind of brings you down, or reading a book, whatever it might be. But staying away from that stimulating activity. So that'd be first thing I'd say. The next thing I'd say is look at your sleeping environment. Is it optimal for sleep and recovery? So if you're at home, does your own sleeping environment, is it cool? Is it somewhere between 18 to 25 degrees? And generally men will like it colder and women will like a warmer in the room. Is there enough airflow as well? Are you removing any sources of natural light so you can kind of delay the next morning wake up if you want to get some extra sleep? Because natural light coming in the morning will wake you up. Have you been adequately hydrated? Have you had enough food and so on that's going to allow you to, you know, maintain that sleep? You're not going to wake up hungry. If you're traveling, then the use of eye masks and earplugs if you're in hotels, eliminating light sources again, using aircon and so on. All of these things can help to improve the sleeping environment, you know, to maximize sleep. In addition to that, I don't see too many athletes doing this, but avoiding alcohol will definitely help as well, because whilst alcohol may help you fall asleep, it's going to disrupt sleep once you've consumed it. So about 2 or 3 hours, you're going to start having disruption or fragmentation in sleep, and you're going to have a lot of frequent awakenings to go to the bathroom as well.
Okay. That's really interesting. I suppose from a coaching perspective, the tendency is it's a little bit of a ritual, I suppose, for most coaches. They'll finish the game, they'll go home, they live on fast food or takeaway because that's just what's convenient at the time. A couple of drinks at night and all of a sudden it's 2 a.m. Yeah. And where did the night go, sort of thing. So what are some tips to maybe bring coaches down after a game, and probably players too who are highly aroused after a game? How do you come back down, I suppose? Because normally after a game, you think through it and you say, hey, did I do this well? Did I do this poorly? What could I have done better? And the mental state just continues to tick over. How can you bring yourself down mentally after a game?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, and I think it's going to vary again for individuals. And I sound a bit like an economist or a politician at the moment, because it's like it depends for everything. What I would say is have a system in place for after a game for coaches and athletes. So if the coaches are going to talk to the athletes after the game, have a kind of a debrief. You see this done very well in military after a firefight or in infantry, or they have some sort of contact situation. They do this debrief and reorg very good, and then just get on with it for the next one. So that happens really good. And I think some of those principles could be applied. So have a kind of a standardized format. You know, when you finish the game, you know, you do media, foam rolling, nutrition, whatever it is. And maybe then the coaches give a debrief when they're having food or before, whatever works for the team, whatever you agree on. And you kind of follow a pro forma. So there might be 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, whatever many things is going to be that you go through, and you try and get that done within 15 minutes. So you try and clear the decks, you kind of have a quick reflection on the game, what's for the next game, especially with these double headers. Similarly for the coaches, when all the athletes are gone, you guys should sit back and do the same thing as well. As a group, have a kind of a quick reorg. If that is grabbing a drink, if you really feel like doing that, have one drink, sit there, have your debrief, have your reorg, and then split and follow the same principles as well, like I was saying for the athletes. I think we have a tendency sometimes as leaders, particularly, to stay up later. I've been guilty of this as well in research studies or even in the military or in mining, and try to kind of get things ready for the athletes the next day. And my challenge to coaches who often sleep less than the athletes, if you're the captain of the ship, right, making this strategy, how good is the strategy going to be the next day? If you can't think on the fly, if your cognitive performance is going to be affected, if you're feeling groggy, or you're getting moody or agitated, that's going to transfer to the players. So you have to lead by example. and you have to be able to demonstrate these behaviors as well. So kind of we're starting to cross into cultural stuff and leadership and so on, but I think these type of things are really important. The last point I'll make, particularly, well, actually, this is for athletes as well, individuals and for leaders. If you're going to bed and you feel like you're bringing too much to bed with you and your kind of head is cluttered, get a piece of paper, write down what's bugging you, take 5-10 minutes, write these things down, make an action list tonight for tomorrow about the things you want to do in the morning. And maybe that could be, I'm going to get my clothes ready, my uniform, pack my bag, so I know when I go to sleep, all that's ready. And I'm not going to bed thinking about what I got to do in the morning. So you get up the next morning and you've got steps 1 to 10 to do. That's a strategy I employ myself personally. And also when I do ultra runs, around 100 Ks or even to 100 miles, before I go to bed, I pack all my race gear. It's all laid out. So in the morning, I got to wake up, eat that banana, put on that coffee pot, put on those clothes, and I'm just gone into routine mode. So I think Dan John, the strength and conditioning coach, calls it, you want to shark as many things as possible. So he's a guy that wears, like, you know, he's got 15 black polo shirts. So he just have to think about stuff. It's automatic. And that's what you want to try and do for that recovery as well. Have as much things automated so it's easy to do.
Definitely. And I know it's something that a lot of coaches struggle with, in particular when it gets into tournament play. How much should they do the night of and how much should they put it off to the next day?
Yeah.
Are you better off staying up late and getting it done, or are you better off going to bed and getting up early the next morning to try and get all your jobs done?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I know some coaches like to go back and look at footage after a game. They want to look at the stats and the whole lot. But if it's 2 o'clock in the morning or 1 o'clock in the morning, number one, you're not going to be at your top cognitive function. And so I'm going to go back here on some sleep science.
Yep.
So we go to sleep. We're diurnal animals. We're supposed to sleep at night. We're not meant to be awake during the day. We're supposed to be asleep at night. We're not meant to sleep during the day. And I think I said awake during the day. We're not supposed to be asleep during the day. We're supposed to be awake during the day and asleep at night. So when we go to sleep, we go through a number of different phases. So we, from about roughly, let's say we go to bed at 10 o'clock, we fall asleep at 11. We have non-REM sleep from 11 till about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. Non-REM sleep is really good for physical repair and recovery. This is stages 1, 2, and 3. And stage 3 sleep is where we have growth hormone released. It's where our body does repair and recovery. From a physical standpoint. And then we go into REM sleep, rapid eye movement, from about 3 o'clock to 6 o'clock, and this is dreaming sleep. And so deep sleep is different than dreaming sleep, and often people will say it's the same thing, but they're not. And so if you are staying up and you're eating into that time, when naturally occurring, you're affecting your own recovery. And secondly as well, if you're getting eaten into that time, particularly past 3 o'clock, your cognitive performance is going to be, you know, bottoming out, your body temperature is going to be low. How good is reviewing this tape going to be? And I think many people will attest to being awake at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and you're doing something and you're zoned out and tell myself, like, what was I even doing? So really, how good is it? And again, I'll go back to having a kind of a standardization or a pro forma to apply to that post game to lead into the next game.
That's fantastic advice. I'm sitting here listening to you say that. I know you've mucked this up a couple of times, in all honesty, where I've sort of tried to push through that night and I've been rubbish the next day. And it makes a huge difference just to myself, I suppose. Before coming into this, we did ask around for a couple of coaches to say, hey, is there anything you want to know about before we come in here? And one of the ones that came up was sleep banking.
Yeah.
Is it real? Like, can you sit there and say, hey, I'm going to get 12 hours of sleep over 3 nights and that'll help me throughout, as opposed to I'm just going to get 8 consistently every night and even through the tournament?
Well, there was and there is still a bit of controversy among sleep scientists around sleep banking, because what happens is when people say sleep banking, they think that you can just, or it gets interpreted wrong. So some people think, oh yeah, well, I can just have crap sleep Monday to Thursday because I'm working, and then I'll just bank up on sleep over the weekend and get through it. And so you're cycling in and out constantly. Now, that's not really good to do. And so that's bad sleep hygiene practices, because we talk about in sleep hygiene having a routine. So the more you can have a routine, the better. What I would say is I would call it more about sleep optimization. And we see military doing this, special forces do this. There was a paper published last year by Yarnell. And he spoke about, spoke about the strategy around pre-mission deployment sleep optimization. So if a soldier was going away for 4 or 5 days on a mission, they would optimize sleep or stay in bed longer for 10 or 12 hours to optimize fully that sleep, as opposed to cutting it short, only getting 6 hours, getting up because they think they got to get up. And so that did help performance. And recently out of Canada, we see some stuff coming out speaking about sleep banking in athletes as well, and it's beneficial. Now, in the research we did at the Western Force, we actually found that the Western Force were doing sleep banking or optimization in the nights leading up. So I spoke about after a game that was pretty poor sleep,
yep.
but the night before the game, some athletes were getting 10, 11 hours of sleep, which was awesome. Yep. So they were actually kind of, you would see across the week that before a game, sleep duration would increase. After the game, it was reduced. Then it started increasing again. And then it was reduced as well. So yes, sleep, to answer the question, sleep banking is real. And if you're going into a double header where there's travel and you know recovery is going to be impacted, I would really focus on sleep banking in the days leading into that double header. Now, in saying that, how do you do sleep banking correctly?
Yep.
And this is going to depend on the athlete. So there's something what's called chronotypes. So some people are early morning people, some people are late people, some people are kind of in the middle, and they often get characterized as a lark, a middler, or in-betweener, and then an owl chronotype. Now, generally for younger athletes, they will tend to be more like an owl chronotype, go to bed and get up late. So if you are scheduling training, let's say on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday before a doubleheader on a Saturday and a Sunday, there's no point in having training sessions at 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, particularly athletes under 25, because if you want to optimize sleep or increase sleep, don't do it at the front end with young athletes, do it at the back end and delay the training start times till maybe 10, 11 or 12. Some teams that train in the afternoon actually have an advantage because the morning's free, the athletes get to sleep in, and then also they're taking advantage of naturally occurring circadian biology. In the afternoon, between sort of 3 and 6 o'clock in that time, is when you have the best coordination, the best reaction time, the best muscular strength, and the best cardiovascular efficiency. So if you're training around those times, you're optimizing that naturally occurring thing. Now, that can be difficult as well in basketball, because you do have some games at 12 o'clock in the day and others in the evening, but you're sort of in the middle there. So I would say look at the chronotype of your athletes, sleep bank appropriately before the games, but look at the training schedules as not to reduce the opportunity to increase sleep.
Incredibly interesting. One of the other questions we had was the use of phones, and you touched on it a little bit in terms of don't be aroused by the phone. The blue light one keeps getting thrown up, and there's too much blue light in the room, and it's in the TV, and it's in the phones, and it's in the iPads. Real or myth?
I'm going to get in trouble, because part of me, when I started off my PhD, was like, bloody electronic devices, blah, 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 and being a bit older. For those of you who can't see me, I have white hair. used to be brown, then it went grey, now it's gone white. I think I'm starting to go bald now as well, so I'm going through all the colours. So I was in the same camp. However, I did a study at the AIS with young judo athletes, found no effect.
Wow.
So we took electronic devices, laptops, phones, everything away from 48 hours during a training camp. Another colleague of mine, Madison Jones, did an in-laboratory study using PSG, gold standard for assessing sleep. She had different tasks, so looking at iPads, looking at phones, looking at magazines, doing puzzles. She found no effect either. She measured melatonin, cortisol. She found no effect, right? Now, it's a bit controversial,
yep.
But we do think it may not be so much electronic device. It may be the type of activity that's going on. And we do know from talking to athletes individually and anecdotally, not in studies, that when they do get on social media, start responding to messages or criticism after competition or during competition, which we didn't measure, that's when it becomes problematic. Okay? So I think it's more the activity. Now, so the research is kind of divided. A lot of electronic device research has been done in very young kids who are not athletes, or middle-aged adults who are not athletes. And so getting to specific athlete populations is difficult. And the research that's been conducted in athletes is a little bit mixed at the moment. So I think it's an area that's growing. But I would say for people with electronic devices, it's more about the activity, I think. So the stimulating activity that's occurring after the game or a competition.
You're a brave man to take technology off off young athletes as well. Like, there's normally a bit of fight that comes with that, and especially if they're in the judo background. You're very lucky you're trained in jiu-jitsu.
Well, it was lucky because, interesting enough, in that study, most of the guys were like, yeah, take it. We're in a judo camp. We're here to train. Where a lot of females were like, we like our phone. So I don't know if that's,
yep.
I don't know if that's, you know, something that goes on or what the background. I could have just been unlucky.
Yep.
But it was interesting. The guys were like, we don't care about it. But the females tended to want to have, you know, the phones with them. I don't know whether it's a kind of a security thing or what's going on. Maybe I'm too old. I'm not cool anymore to find out what's really going on. I don't know. In that camp, I also found out what Snapchat was. So I don't know, man. I'm behind the ball.
If it makes you feel any better, I'm no better off. I've kind of got my head around Facebook. I kind of understand Instagram and Twitter. After that, I've got nothing left, unfortunately. Napping. Now, this is a big one for me. I know there were plenty of times where I'd be coaching at 9:45 at night. I'd get home at 6:00 from work, and I'd have that sort of downtime in between, and it's like, what am I doing? Am I going to just sit here and just wait for the game? Am I better off going out, going for a walk? Am I better off having a quick nap? And there were times where a 20-minute nap would perk me up really quickly. There were times where that 20 minutes turned into 3 hours, and I was sluggish as the time I came out of it. Are there any recommendations around napping?
Yeah, good point. And like Conor McGregor, the MMA athlete, says timing is everything. And it is, again, with napping. So if you want to look at the best times to nap, and so if you're an endurance athlete and you're doing these multi-day races where you're awake, the best time to take a nap is between 3 and 6 o'clock in the morning or asleep, or between 1 and 3 in the afternoon. I'm going to plug my own podcast here, Sleep for Performance Radio. I had an athlete on episode 9, Gavin McClurk, who was an extreme athlete, and he raced from Salzburg in Austria to Monaco, hand gliding and running for 10 days. And so we actually used that 3 to 6 o'clock in the morning time for him to get sleep. And so that was the part where we did it. And we only had, if he was going to take a nap, it was between 1 and 3 o'clock in the day. The reason being, they're naturally occurring lows in a circadian cycle. So circadian comes from the word circa, about, dia meaning a day for Latin-based people. And so you have these two naturally occurring dips where the body temperature goes down. Right about now, when we're recording the podcast, Rob, we'll just be coming out of this naturally occurring dip in the afternoon, or post-lunch dip, often gets referred to as a siesta. Your comment is very interesting about the timing, because naps should be either 20 minutes, 90 minutes, or 4 hours. And so if you, I think when it goes past 20 minutes, it's not really a nap, it's a sleep episode. And so what happens then is, if you kind of wake up at 2.5 hours or it might be, you have what's called sleep inertia, which is that groggy feeling. Many listeners will experience this when they have to get up at 4:30 in the morning to go and get a flight at the airport. They feel pretty crap. They feel a bit dozy. So my recommendation to counteract sleep inertia is caffeine. Yep. So if you're taking a nap between 1 and 3 o'clock in the afternoon, or if you're driving somewhere and you want to take a nap, consume the caffeine, take the nap. And the reason being, I spoke about pharmacokinetics of caffeine. When you wake up, the caffeine's going to kick, give you a double kick to get you out of that sleep inertia, and away you go. And so we use that in industry a lot, to strategically use caffeine to drive people out of sleep inertia and get them back up operating at, you know, full performance.
That's fantastic. I'd never actually thought of that, but that's a fantastic way of doing things. Probably the last sort of question we had from some of our coaches, wearable technology. So I'd say this with an iWatch on at the moment. I know there are countless athletes that run around with Fitbits, Jawbones, everything like that, just to track how many steps they have. Is there any value in having that with sleep? And the reason I ask this is, a couple of years ago, we tracked our athletes in our under-16 state team in terms of how much sleep they were getting throughout the week. And we just had them write it on a spreadsheet, and it was nothing spectacular by any means. But we tracked it, and we sort of found the kids that got upwards of 8 hours sleep tended to have less injuries, whereas the kids that were getting less than 8 hours sleep per night tended to get injured more. And it was mainly soft tissue things like a hamstring, just general soreness. Is there any validity, I suppose, in the wearable tracking, or just monitoring your own sleep in your own time?
Yeah, this is a great question. And it's one as well that gets heavily debated. So we need to understand the spectrum of how to monitor sleep, or how to assess sleep. So we'll start at the top. We got polysomnography, which I spoke about. Top level, gold standard in a laboratory. People wired up. You may see pictures of this all over their electrodes, all over their head, their face, thoracic bands on their chest, leg movements, video camera movement, sleep tech watching them overnight. This big panel of all this EEG, ECG, EMG going on. It's very scientific and very cool looking, and people like to come in and take pictures of them in the lab. And so that's how we assess sleep. That's traditionally used, though, for assessing sleep disorders.
Okay.
And we can talk about that a little bit more if you wish. So that's typically used for that. It's not really representative of a night's sleep. Then at the other end of the scale, you've got self-reported sleep. Rob, how did you sleep last night? And you go, got 6 hours, feel pretty crap. Okay. Then in the middle, you have wearable technologies. So it's like the Goldilocks thing.
Yeah.
Some is, one's really good, one's really bad, and wearables are in the middle. Now, sleep diaries and all that are down sort of self-reported thing. And then with polysomnography, you've got PSG levels 1, 2, 3, and 4. And as it kind of goes down to 4, we drop off channels, or it gets less, it's got less kind of scientific data for us to use. We get into the middle of our own wearable technologies, things that are worn on the hip, the wrist, and so on. And now we can, let's, if we think about magnifying glass, there's a range of technologies in there again. Some are validated, some aren't. And they're all very different. And they use accelerometry, generally three-dimensional accelerometry, so on X, Y, Z axis. And it's just basically looking at movement or periods of wake and not awake. And so, like I said earlier, I validated the technology, the ReadyBand, against PSG. And it performs as good as another device against PSG. So coming back onto your answer, to your question, wearable technologies are good. However, be cautious. Make sure that, number one, the technology is validated, or you have someone at least give you some indication of how good it is. Secondly, I would say don't try to compare different technologies. So if you have an Apple Watch, I have a ReadyBand, and Johnny Bananas has got a Fitbit on, all of that is going to be slightly different. So everybody should be wearing the same device if you're going to have it within a team. So it should be across the board. And then on top of that as well, it is a good indication of sleep that's happening, but it's not the definitive. So it's not going to be, you know, you still need to talk to the athlete and where you're starting to see issues with sleep, where it be awakenings, fragmentation, and all these other things that you're saying about injuries and performance, then you kind of got enough markers now to go, there's a problem here. And then you can upgrade that individual athlete to PSG. And then you can refer them and go, look, we need you to go to the lab. We want to figure out what's going on and go and see a sleep specialist.
Yeah. That's great. And probably my last question, I suppose, quantity or quality, which one matters more in terms of sleep? Because I know there have been nights where I've woken up after a 3-hour nap and felt $1 million. But there are times I've slept 12 hours and wake up the next morning feeling like crap. Like, what is probably the more important of the two?
Interesting question. I'm going to come back on a point I made in a previous answer, which is about sleep disorders. Currently, there's over 80 recognized sleep disorders by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, which many people are not aware of. And so you can look at quantity. And if you look at quality or efficiency or a metric of utilization, you could be in bed for 10 hours, but you're only getting 6 hours of sleep, which then drives that utilization down. So quantity and quality are kind of interlinked. So there's kind of, you know, it's kind of a chicken and egg type of thing. One is driving the other. So when we talk about those metrics, what I would actually say, what's more important in quantity and quality is consistency. And for me, that's all I'm trying to do with athletes. So look, if they're doing 6 hours of sleep a night, can we move that to 6 hours and 15? Has that made the athlete feel better? Has that resulted in better performance? And that performance can be broken into cognitive performance and physical performance, or kind of individual performance separately, where the person even just feels better, they're less grumpy, or, you know, it's having a positive effect on how they feel during the day. Because the other thing as well, as you have to look at with sleep as well, and there's a whole other raft you can get into, is when you have poor quality sleep, poor quantity sleep, it affects your metabolism, which leads to weight gain. Weight gain then leads to issues with obstructive sleep apnea, which lead then to fragmentation of sleep, which reduce the quantity, which affect the quality, and you get yourself in this vicious cycle. And then that keeps getting out of sync. You're tired, so you go for crazier, fattier foods or sugary foods. You gain weight, it gets worse. Now you develop other things like depression, maybe diabetes, and it keeps spinning out of control. So I would come back to consistency and then try and move it up each night and have that consistent behavior across all nights. And this is something I would say to athletes as well, is you can be really good Monday to Friday, play a game on Friday night, but if you go out on Saturday and Sunday and hit the town and you're out till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, now you're going to take days to get back up again. So you're just, like, you know, you're throwing rocks into your backpack here. You're just making it more difficult for yourself.
That's incredibly valuable information, especially about the welfare side of things, in terms of how it can spiral and pigeonhole. There are plenty of coaches I know that sleep 2 and 3 hours a night when it's been game nights and come back the next day, and I just don't know how they do it. It's just an incredibly important part of coaching I don't think we put enough time into, and something we can help our kids with. And if we can get them on better track, well, we get more out of them, I think, down the line.
probably one of the best ways to learn more about the impact on sleep and athletes, and as well as how can people get in contact with you and your website and Twitter and everything like that as well, because I know that's where I found you, was Fire Another Podcast, and then followed you on Twitter, and there's all sorts of infographics, which I love, on everything about how this is impacts that and this impacts that. How can people learn more about this?
Yeah, so if you're really kind of geeky and scientific and you like to read papers, you can, you know, search my name on PubMed and find out there. You know, and there's a whole host of people there. Or you can just send me an email at iandunican@sleepforperformance.com.au, and I can give this all for the show notes afterwards. So you can just do that, and I'm happy to respond and provide people with information there. So if you'd like to do that. On top of that, you can go to my website, sleepforperformance, and that's the number 4.com.au. There's blogs up there. There's little YouTube videos up there from TV appearances and other stuff as well. There's also my podcast up there. I think I just had 15 episodes go out, and they're a combination of athletes, amateur, professional. We've had coaches on, extreme athletes, people from industry. So you kind of get this flavor of lots of different types of people across the sleep world. And that's called Sleep for Performance Radio, and that's on iTunes and Podbean. So you can go there, and like I said, on the website there's blogs and so on, and you can subscribe on my site as well, and you can keep up to date with the blogs and all that sort of stuff coming out, or any other sort of news. And in addition, there's some free downloads there, like a little book on jet lag and so on, so you can get that there. On Twitter, you can follow me at Sleep for Perform, I think. Yep, is that right? Yeah. Sleep for Perform, on Instagram as well. So you'll see me on there, not just talking about sleep, but commenting on fights, rugby, winding people up, debating people, being a bit of what they call a troll sometimes, having a laugh. So if you come over there, expect to hear lots of crazy stuff. And the same on Instagram, I like to post my running and sort of activity. So a little bit of inspiration there for some people who want to get going. And so you can kind of head to those and find out what's going on. And this week as well, Rob, I had my TEDx Perth talk released. So I did a talk at TEDx Perth on November 11th last year, called Sleep In and Win. And so you can search that on YouTube and you'll find that TEDx. There's actually two Sleep In and Wins, one from the Perth Links work I did. And then there's this TEDx talk as well. And that goes for about 9 minutes. And that gives a really nice overview of sleep and performance in industry and athletes, and a little bit more background on me. So you can go over there and head there. So lots of free stuff. Always welcome, though, to email me. If you've got a specific question, we'll turn into a blog or a podcast even, if I keep getting enough. And just happy to talk to people. As you can probably tell, I don't shut my mouth about it. So, yeah.
That's fantastic. And I really do appreciate your time. And I certainly would recommend, it's a great follow on Twitter. I did watch the TED Talk yesterday. You do hear the number 33 on the TED Talk. You can go and listen to that yourselves, though. A little bit different how I say it to how I end it.
Well, now, there's a story behind that. I did say in the rehearsal day before, I said one third. And people were like, a third? And I was like, oh, God, I'm going to have to do something about this. But they were the numbers. They were the actual numbers from the Sleep Health Foundation. So I'm not going to fudge numbers. I will take the slagging. I will take the mockery for science, because that's the kind of guy I am, Rob.
Data doesn't lie. You cannot refute that. So, I do absolutely recommend going and have a look at that. It's fascinating data, and I think it's something that as coaches we can certainly educate our players better on, and we can be better educated on as well. But, Ian, thanks very much for your time. It's been insightful for me personally, and hopefully a lot of our coaches follow along and start to put a little bit of time into their athlete's sleep and their own sleep as well.
No worries. Thanks, Rob. Cheers.